The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, great to see you today, folks. Great to see you. I thought we might begin with a message from the man who became president of the United States. This is before he became president. But if someone does the wrong thing to you, how should you respond? Let's see.
Get even. When somebody screws you, screw them back instead.
They're just the man you want to put in charge of the world's biggest army, isn't it? And the world's most powerful nation.
Get even. When somebody screws you, screw them back in spades.
Somebody screws you, screw them back in spades. So, get even. You reckon that's the way the world works? I'd put it to you often. It certainly feels that way. Here's some statements about... See if you think this is how the world works. By the way, at great expense, the Bible Shots brings you a colour insert today. A colour, I hope you're impressed. You might like to have a look. I'll read those eight little statements under the colour book covers. Happy are the successful, for they control their own lives. Happy are those with calloused consciences, for they're enjoying life. Happy are the assertive, for they get what they want. Happy are the morally indifferent. They live how they wish. Happy are those who take revenge, for they always get even. Happy are those who are comfortable with their own foibles. I guess for they're comfortable. Happy are the agitators, for they will be noticed. Happy are those who don't believe in anything too much, for they'll have a nice, easy life. It does feel like that's the way the world works sometimes, doesn't it? If you're aggressive, if you're pushy, you get what you want. If you look at those book titles that are on the insert or here on the screen, they're big sellers. Donald Trump's Art of the Deal and so on. How to Be an Alpha Male, Assertiveness Guide for Women. It feels like it's the way the world works. Now, we've seen what Mr. Trump thinks about if someone does the wrong thing to you and how to live. Today we're going to actually look at someone... and a man who taught a very, very different attitude to life. As we've been working our way through Matthew's Gospel week by week, we're up to chapter 5, and we're up to perhaps the most famous speech ever given, the Sermon on the Mount. Interesting, Jesus talks in the Sermon on the Mount about how to live in the kingdom of heaven, how to know God as your king, really, how to know him. In Mark and Luke, they both talk about Jesus teaching about the kingdom of God, but because Matthew was written, certainly written for a Jewish audience as well as others, but had Jewish people in mind, they never used the personal name of God, and so Matthew will talk about the kingdom of heaven. Sermon on the Mount, you can read it out loud in about 12 minutes, I think, Matthew 5, 6, 7. Simple language, and yet I put it to you, anybody who says they're comfortable with the Sermon on the Mount has never actually read it. So let's have a look at it. On the inside of the program that you're given is the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5. To put it in context, Jesus has been teaching and preaching and healing, and crowds have come to him from all over the country, north, south, east and west. I think at first they came because he could heal. They brought the sick to him, but they're also amazed at how he taught. So see chapter 5 verse 1. Now when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on a mountainside and sat down. So he's up in the north, up near Galilee. His disciples came to him and he began to teach them. The way the Sermon on the Mount works is, his disciples are, if you like, sitting in the front row, although not explicitly just the 12 apostles, they're mentioned later in chapter 10, so it's those who have begun to follow him. In the background... are the people who are just kind of listening, if you like, the crowd. Disciples at the front, the crowd at the back. And you get to the end of the Sermon on the Mount, and we're told, when Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds were amazed at his teaching, because he taught them as one who had authority, and not as their teachers of the law. So I don't know where you are in terms of what you think about Jesus. You might think of yourself as a disciple who, yep, I want to follow him. Or maybe you're just one of the crowd wanting to sit at the back, rub your chin, have a think. That's fine. It works both ways today. Now, what have I done? If you look at those eight little statements under the colour insert, what have I done? Well, I've called them the B attitudes, if you like, the B attitudes. And all I've done there is reverse what Jesus says in verses 3 to 10. And the reason I did that is just to get the feel, because I think what Jesus does in the Beatitudes, I'll explain why they're called that in a moment, what Jesus does in the Beatitudes is to reverse the way that our world usually works. And if you turn Jesus' words back again, you get the way our world works. Jesus reverses it. Those little statements are blessed. They're called the Beatitudes. Why? The Latin word for blessed is beatus. And so Beatitudes, those who are blessed. To be blessed in the Bible, a little bit hard to kind of nail it down into an English word. It's the one who's approved by God, the one that God smiles upon. You could almost say it's the person you'd want to be. Almost the one you should be envious of, if you like, if you know what I mean. The one who lives the good life. There's eight different things said there. It's not eight different kinds of disciple. It's more like one of those identikit photos where they put together different slices of some impossible faces and make up a picture of someone's face. It's eight different angles on what it would mean to be a disciple of Jesus. Okay, enough talk from me. Let me read what it is that Jesus says, and you have a think about what it would be like to try and live this way. So he went up onto the mountain. He said, verse 3, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." Does it look like the good life? Well, you'd be honest, not at first. It looks pretty hard work, doesn't it? And it also looks like a big chance that you'll get walked on if you live this way, especially in kind of friendly Sydney, right? Very different to hedonism, or appears to be. Now, I think I'd be right in saying that hedonism is kind of the default position for many, many Australians. Now, what do I mean by hedonism? Here's a definition from the Oxford Dictionaries. Hedonism, the ethical theory that pleasure, in the sense of the satisfaction of desires, is the highest good and proper aim of human life. Now, I know hedonism's often talked about as kind of letting your appetites rule, so overindulgence in all sorts of things. But I like that definition because what it's saying is there's a little more than that. There's hedonism that says, "Oh well, I spent most of my money on wild women and alcohol, and I just wasted the rest." All right, but there's a hedonism that says that knows if I'm drunk every night or eating like a glutton every meal, in the long run, it's not good for me. There's a hedonism that they call it ethical hedonism, which means you kind of think you play the long game and know there's certain behaviours that in the long run will satisfy your desires. It seems like Jesus is a million miles from that. What's he saying? You know, blessed are the poor in spirit, blessed are those who mourn. And now, is it the opposite of meeting your desires or not? Let's have just a little bit of a look further, dig around a bit, and I think you might be surprised at what you see. Now, in terms of the structure, see, verse 5 and verse 10 are like bookends, because they both have the phrase there, "Theirs is the kingdom of heaven." Verse 10, "Theirs is the kingdom of heaven." And verses 11 and 12, I think, really just flesh out what Jesus means about being persecuted or suffering for following him. And the way that they're broken up The first section, the first four of the Beatitudes, is about the inner character of the disciple, or perhaps their attitude before God. So poor in spirit, those who mourn, the meek, those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. If a person has that character, it'll flow out into the way they treat other people. And that's the next four, the behaviour of the disciple or their attitude towards other people. So merciful, pure in heart, peacemakers, persecuted for righteousness. I don't have time to go into all of them, but each of those little phrases, the blessed phrases, are packed with Old Testament content. It's the Old Testament that's the background to pretty much everything that Jesus teaches. Let me see if I can show you. The first one, in verse 3, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. In the Old Testament, to be poor in spirit, there's kind of an evolution of the way that word's used. To be economically poor meant that you would be dependent on people, that you'd almost always have to be humble. And I guess there's a drift with that to the idea of being spiritually poor, which is acknowledging your bankruptcy before God. It's acknowledging that when you come before God and the way you live, you come empty-handed. It means you'll be humble before Him. In the Old Testament, there's a promise about God sending His servant, God sending someone. It's about Jesus. Notice what he says, the Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is on me, in Isaiah, this is about 800 BC, because the Lord has anointed me, what? To proclaim good news to the poor. He sent me to bind up the brokenhearted and proclaim freedom from the captives and release from darkness for the prisoners, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favour, the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn. Jesus is saying, if you're poor in spirit, if you can acknowledge your spiritual bankruptcy before God, that's what it means to live in the kingdom of heaven. To really, I guess it's the exact opposite of being proud before God. Saying, I'm a good person. Actually, no, I'm not. I'm spiritually bankrupt. Or if you look at the next one, for example, verse 4, blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. My wife Kathy took her mum to a funeral this morning. Kathy's mum's best friend died last week. Very sad. She was in her 90s, but still very sad. Now, a lot of people will think what this promise means is if you're at a funeral and you're feeling sad, you're mourning, that God will comfort you. Now, that's true, but it's not quite. I don't think it's quite what Jesus means. Did you notice in that, like the quote that I had from the prophet Isaiah, do you notice at the end, God promises that one day He'll comfort those who mourn. A number of times in the prophecy of Isaiah, it's talking about that. Now, in the prophets in the Old Testament, particularly the idea of mourning was about a sadness or mourning about sin or failure in our own lives, or mourning over the way that other people, or maybe your nation or your tribe or your group are treated and behave before God. How they treated one another or how they behave before God. And there's a mourning or a sadness that comes when you live with people who don't treat each other properly and don't treat God properly. It's not judgmentalism, it's a sadness about the way people act. And the promise is that one day God will come and comfort or deal with that problem. There's a story in the New Testament. I don't know if you've read it. The beginning of Luke's Gospel, when Jesus is as a baby, he's 8 days old. According to the Old Testament law, Mary and Joseph take him from Bethlehem to Jerusalem, which is only 2 or 3 hours' walk. 8 days old, they take him to be circumcised as a little boy. And there's an old man there called Simeon. And here's what Luke says: Now there was a man in Jerusalem called Simeon who was righteous and devout. He was waiting for the consolation of Israel, and the Holy Spirit was on him. Now, the NIV goes for consolation, which is fine, but it's exactly the same word as Jesus says in the Beatitudes about comforting. And what's Simeon waiting? He's waiting for God to send someone, God to send his king, who will comfort or fix up and deal with the problem of sin and so on. And the story goes that Simeon sees the baby Jesus and knows that this is the one who will comfort those who mourn. All right, let's got time for maybe one or two more. See verse 5. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Now, it's the word get, it could be earth or it could be land. It's the idea of you'll get your inheritance from God. And meek not doesn't mean weak. Perhaps it might be better to translate it as gentle. What's gentleness? Gentleness is strength used carefully to look after people. He's saying, if you can be meek, if you can be gentle in the way that you treat people, why can you be gentle? Because God has things under control and you won't miss out on your inheritance. And then verse 6, those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, you'll be filled. If you want the things of God, God will give them to you. And then the way it works is those four statements about your inner character, if you follow Jesus, and then they'll show themselves in how you treat others, to be merciful, to be pure in heart, a peacemaker. But you notice verse 10, persecuted. Verse 11, blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven, for in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Ironically, isn't it? You can be the one who's meek, humble, gentle, and Jesus is saying, you do that, and you follow me, and they will persecute you. You will suffer for it. He's saying, he doesn't say go out and look for it. He's going to go out and look for persecution. He's saying it'll come to you. Just kind of an irony of the world we live in. And then he talks about, I think we're going to be a bit short on time, so I won't. Then he talks about saltiness, which I think the idea of the disciple being distinctive, verse 13. And then if you are distinctive, you'll be like light on a hill. That people will, verse 16, that people will see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven. When Jesus' followers live this way, treat other people this way, it actually points to God and gives him glory. People will praise God. So whoever said, thank God for the salvos, got it right. All right. Let me just kind of wrap up. I think it's hard for everyone to live this way. But there's, I guess for some of us, it can be extra hard. And that is, if you're naturally a kind of, how can I put it, in-your-face, outgoing, pushy kind of person with a big voice and like to get your own way, not that I'm thinking of anybody in particular, but it can be hard to live this way. But my guess is for everybody it's hard. It's hard to be spiritually self-aware before God, to be humble and realise we bring nothing before him, to ask for forgiveness. Gentleness is hard because we do all like to get our own way. To forgive is difficult. And what's Jesus saying? Where does faith fit into all this? It's the idea that you can trust God enough that you can live this way and know that God has things in hand and you won't miss out. Remember I talked about hedonism, the idea of the greatest good in life is to have your desires met. I think it is that Jesus does want to meet our desires, because our desires are not wrong. To simplify or maybe oversimplify things a bit, I think deep down, what do people want? Well, we want to feel like we matter, like we're important. Now, you can call that love or status or respect or whatever you want. We want to feel like we matter, like we're worth something. And doesn't that drive so much of our behaviour? And the other great desire is to feel secure or safe or that everything will be okay. Those desires are not wrong. The thing that Jesus points out again and again is we just look to meet those desires in the wrong ways. Ways that don't satisfy, or ways that are destructive, or ways that damage other people, or dishonour God. What Jesus is on about is meeting our desires long term. And if you look at the promises, what does he say? If you'll trust God, if you'll aim to live this way, ask God to change you, says, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven, for they will be comforted, for they will inherit the earth, for they will be filled, for they will be shown mercy, they will see God, they will be called children of God. To know God and to find our security and significance in him, that, if you like, that's real hedonism. That's long term. So if you're not yet a follower of Jesus, there's the great challenge. Will you trust God and ask him to change you to be like this? And if you do follow Jesus, I know all I've done today is to skate over the surface. It's well worth the time to pause and maybe each day have a think about one of those character aspects and ask that God might change us to be like that. Did you guys hear that? Is there a progression? If you start with recognising you're spiritually poor, and then you kind of move on. I think you're probably right, certainly about the starting point. I don't know if it's all sequential, but I think he starts with the idea of you being aware of your own poverty before God. Is if you haven't got that, you haven't got anywhere to start. I have to think about the. Do you want to say any more about where they obviously progress?
Perhaps if it's not such obvious, you could argue that there was a progression there.
Certainly, you're right in the starting point, and maybe the finishing point. Live this really great life, and people will persecute you. maybe I'm not sure about exact progression in the middle.
Yeah.
Once you get those first few right. Not that I have, but let's assume that someone did. I think then you are in a position to be merciful and forgive because you're aware of your own failings. Yeah. But, yeah, it's a good point. Any other thoughts, folks? Craig?
How do you think God gets the glory at the end?
Ah, right. Okay. Yeah, I ran out of time to really look at...
question for the recording.
How is it that God gets the glory at the end of 16? I think it is when his people treat each other and other people the way that Jesus says, and you keep reading the Sermon on the Mount, he gives more and more detail. It's very impressive and people can see God at work. I think that's what he means. So if you're loving, kind, forgiving to one another and to others, and you're generous, and it makes an impact on people. Unfortunately, the reverse is also true. So, for example, what we've seen with, the Royal Commission into Child Abuse, where any number of Christian organisations have been dragged in there, and some terrible things have been done. You see what that does to God's reputation and God's glory. It does the exact reverse. So the behaviour of those who claim to follow Jesus affects the way that people think of and speak of him. Yep. Peter?
Could you say a bit more about the word meek? Most of us don't have that in our ordinary vocabulary or use.
Yes. The word meek... if I tell you the Greek word, it's not going to help much, is it? You can translate the word meek as gentle. It's not the same as weak. Jesus says, I am meek and lowly, uses the same word in Matthew chapter 11. And I don't think anyone would ever accuse Jesus of being weak. But gentleness is being strong and yet using that strength under great control, I put it, to care for others. And so I think that's what he's saying. You can be strong, but you can also be gentle. And you notice he's saying you'll be gentle with people and so on. You don't have to be aggressive and pushy, and you will still receive your inheritance. That's the... Yep. I find gentleness very difficult. I've got a big mouth, and I like to get my own way, and I... You know, that's the... Here's where you say, Lachlan, oh, no, that's not true, Al.
Oh, no, Al, that's not true.
So, yeah.
Got his own way again.
Yeah. But meek and weak, not the same thing.
Maybe on that, Al, as I kind of look at that list as well, and you've just sort of said a similar thing, I kind of look at it and think, gosh, that's pretty full on. I'm just aware that I don't do this. Is there any hope for being blessed then, if we're looking at
it? Well, you're feeling spiritually poor, Lachlan.
I feel this is not me, saying, you know?
I think part of what Jesus is doing in the Sermon on the Mount, he'll get to the end of chapter 5 and say, therefore be perfect the way God is perfect. So that, you know, that's tick. No, is the idea of pushing us to see we can't live God's way before him on our own strength, in our own, as Jesus' words, righteousness. And it pushes you to ask for forgiveness and be humble before God. And once you're humble before God, it actually means we'll start treating other people the right way. So I think he's setting the bar very high. But you know, he's saying the first step is being aware of that, and then I think, like John said, there is a progression. That's the base. It's the exact opposite of pride before God. Believe me, I don't measure up on these either. He's just pushing us and saying that's the character, and we need to ask. You want to follow Jesus, ask that God will change us to be like that. Of course, the reward is, if you live that way, you become like Jesus. Or move in that direction.
Thanks. We've got time for one more question. Oh, Peter. So you ask the question for the recording.
Oh, sorry. If someone takes my car spot, right, do I say, oh, here, take the other one as well? Or if someone wants my coat, do I give them my shirt as well? That's what Jesus says in the second half of Matthew chapter 5. So that's why I say anybody who says they're comfortable with the Sermon on the Mount has never read it. I think what Jesus is saying there is, sit lightly to your rights. Okay? So you've been driving around Westfield, someone jumps in the car space ahead of you. You know, it's all right, let it go. Just let it go, go find another one. Okay. When he says, if someone slaps you on one cheek, turn the other cheek as well, he's saying, sit lightly to your honour. Let insults go, I think. Okay. Now, how that works out in exact detail, etc., well, you know, and there's maybe a difference between someone taking a spot in Westfields versus if you have an allocated spot in the building and it's yours and someone parks in it every day and it's the same person, that might be a bit different. Okay, but I think he's saying sit lightly to your rights and privileges and that sort of thing. So he gives a number of examples there about the slap on the cheek. That if they want your coat, let them take your cloak as well, and then, you know, if they force you to go 1 mile, go two, and just relax about your rights, I think, is what he's saying.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.